You're listening to Circle of Hope's Sunday Meeting Podcast. This talk was given at 2007 Frankfurt Avenue. For more information, check out circleofhope.net or join us in person on Sunday evenings at 5 and 7 p.m.
Today, I'm talking about Advent. As you've heard, Advent is a season of waiting. Advent is like labor before birth, a season of hope. I was just talking with Robert before we started. If Christmas happened in like January, right now we'd be thinking about like the end of the year, right? I just think that's interesting that these happen to coincide, that we're at once waiting for a new year and we're waiting for Christmas. I'll specifically be talking about the prophets today, prophets of the Hebrew scriptures and what they say about Jesus over the next 4 weeks though, leading up to Christmas, so 3 more weeks after this. Other people will be talking about other topics as pertaining to Advent. We're gonna try to be as simple, contextual, as elementary as possible. This is a good time if folks you know haven't really encountered the story of Advent, this is a good time. We're also gonna try to contextualize it now for us in our neighborhood, in our situation, in our time. But it is easy to forget that we are not Jewish. We are Gentiles. This is actually, there's a name for this phenomenon. It's happened in Christian history over a long time. It's called supersessionism, of Christians reading themselves as the center of a story of which they're not a part. We come late to the table, right? So in looking at, especially these stories today, it's easy to think that these are all about Jesus, that what's happening before Jesus comes is only about Jesus. That's not true. A lot of people find these writings significant and meaningful for ways that have nothing to do with Jesus. This is something that we claim, though. We're sort of looking through a prism or looking through a hole at these prophets, and I'm going to try not to locate us as the feature of the story, right? We are guests. We are invited to the table by Jesus, and that's our hope. That's our joy, but it's also to mistake that as this story being about us, especially those of us who are white and American, have money. I mean, this is a common feature that gets at the root of a lot of things. We're going to explore the story of starting with King David. You know King David. I think I was thinking, like, who is King David pop culture? I would say Jon Snow is like the King David feature Game of Thrones. He's like the underdog. You know, he's the dude. Everyone's like, oh, is he going to make it? He's the youngest brother. He's like the bastard son, you know, and he ascends. Aragorn as well. Aragorn runs from his kingdom, you know, but he ends up taking over. King David is as popular as these dudes, okay? King David is like the man. When we're reading the King David story, he's the best. He's the best at everything, right? He's the best at fighting. There's a lot of writing about this, how he kills tons of people. Yeah, he's really good at killing people. That's amazing. And okay, he's really good at writing songs. He's good at religion, right? He's the best religious king too, right? He writes a lot of the psalms that we sing, that we use. King David is at the center of religion as well. And he's good at politics. King David sets up Jerusalem, which serves as sort of the seat of Jewish identity, of Jewish religion. King David is at the middle of all of this. And King David is anointed by God. Anointed means oil is put on the head. This was where Samuel was a priest, and he picks David to be the one. This is the one that God has chosen. So all these things that David does have the stamp of approval from God, right? Some cultures call this the divine mandate. It's a big concept in a lot of cosmologies, including in Jewish cosmology, that David is the one who's picked. He's the Messiah. That's the word that can mean anointed one, the Messiah. Here, let's read this real quick. This is 1 Samuel 7, 12 through 16. Thus says the Lord of hosts, I took you from the pasture, from following the sheep to be the prince over my people. I've been with you everywhere you went and have cut off all your enemies from before you. I'll make for you a great name, like the name of the great ones of the earth. I will appoint a place for my people Israel and will plant them so that they may live in their own place and be disturbed no more. And evildoers shall afflict them no more as formerly from the time that I appointed judges over my people Israel. And I will give you rest from all your enemies. Moreover, the Lord declares to you that the Lord will make you a house. When your days are fulfilled, you will lie down with your ancestors. I will raise up your offspring after you, who shall come forth from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be a father to him, and he shall be a son to me. Your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever. So this is part of the covenant commitment of Israel with God. It's this expectation that what David is doing and what David is establishing is what God is doing forever. I think it's easy to forget this when looking back at it now, where clearly that's not the case, right? David was not set up forever. David had a son, Solomon, who came out sort of as the bigger and better David in a lot of ways. There, that last sentence, your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever. This was a critical insight, a critical expectation of the Jewish people. This was the temple that Solomon, David's son, ended up building, saying, this is the place where God is active. This is an artist's rendering, right? We don't have official photos. But we do have the Solomon's temple built in Brazil by evangelist Silas Malafaia. He's worth about $150 million. This is a popular evangelist spreading the prosperity gospel in Brazil, using this same imagery to say, this is what success looks like. This is what the kingdom of God on earth looks like. This is God doing things now, politically, religiously, actively. Silas Malafaia actually recently set up a march to protest the inclusion of LGBTQ rights on the political docket, and the march that he organized actually shot the bill down. It didn't go through. This man has a lot of influence, and he built a temple to mimic Solomon, to say this is the kind of influence that we're looking for. Solomon had a lot of wives, concubines, soldiers. He took censuses. He was the most popular. There's a day where he wakes up and he has this dream, and in the dream, God makes him the wisest man. The most wisest. I'm the wisest of all of them. No one's wiser than me. Other people say they're wise, but I'm the wisest, right? I hear that when I'm reading about Solomon, this sort of Trumpish, like, I'm the best. I'm the one that's been picked. I get everything. And I mean, there's a lot of writings that are ascribed to Solomon, Ecclesiastes. These wisdom writings are said to have been written by Solomon. We're not actually sure. A lot of scholars doubt that. May have been just a fact that it was kind of his personal brand. He may have just assumed them to himself. When we're reading these stories, it's easy to be on the side of David and Solomon. This is a picture of a Korean comfort woman, a statue of a Korean comfort woman that was put on a bus in Japan. The comfort women were abducted, kidnapped from Japan during World War II by the Japanese army. Somewhere around 200,000 women were taken, and they were used as slaves for the Japanese army. Many of them were abused and raped as many as 70 times a day. That's what we're talking about when we're talking about Solomon, right? The story that we get is of this king that had the mark of God on him. The story that we don't get is the story of every one of those wives and concubines. But that's built in. That's part of this. These statues are being put up by Korean activists all over Japan, and even in America, you'll see them in California, because there has not been restitution, there has not been reconciliation. So these artists are trying to force the conversation. It's deeply shameful for everyone. It's really hard. But I want to make sure that we understand that when we're reading the story of Solomon, we're reading the thing that all these people are looking forward to, what the model of a king is, they're talking about that temple, right? That's what they're imagining. Problem is, that collapses. Bad things start happening. The story told is that because the kings were disobedient, because they broke the covenant with God, then God allows the Israelite empire to be broken up. Other empires rise, they take over Israel, and the Israelites are sent into exile. They're subjugated as slaves, as foreigners in other lands. They're refugees. I don't know who made this painting. I just found it on Google. It was a top hit. But I think it gets at the scale of what's happening, right? It's that we're leaving Jerusalem behind. The thing that God had promised forever was going to be the mark of his favor, is not true. We're in exile now. So how to explain that? Because that's a collapse not just of an actual city, it's the collapse of a cosmology, a way of seeing how the world works. That God has picked one place, one specific place, one specific set of people, especially up through one ruler as the person to rule. How could this collapse? Why did that happen? This is a major question. A lot of prophets' writings that we're thinking about today come out in this time. Right, saying, what is God doing? What did we do? How do we make sense of this broken covenant, of this broken system? We were promised greatness, and now we're in exile. Where do we go from here? A lot of Israelite religious leaders, who came to be known as the Pharisees, their common refrain was, we are disobedient. This is another more recent photo. This is of the shtetls in Russia, a similar situation. God brought this about because of our own actions. We're being punished. God isn't broken. We are. The covenant broke because we disobeyed. We need to do better. We need to try better. We need to be more obedient. We need to be more perfect in doing what we couldn't do the first time. So we're going to try again. We're going to have another king at some point. We're going to have another Messiah who will come along and do Jerusalem again, and we'll do it better this time. Or in the case of Esther, a new queen. But someone will do the thing that we couldn't do the first time. This sounds to my ears a lot like a lot of people have a commitment to American politics right now, to both liberals and conservatives, of saying, the problem isn't the system, the problem is how good we are at it, right? We just need to be better. We just need to be more efficient, or we need to be more considerate. We need to be more, like, the system isn't the problem, right? It's not a problem that we have a king. The problem is that we're bad at being kings. We just need to be more obedient, right? It's into this that I want to read Isaiah. This is Isaiah 40. Does someone want to read this slide?
Comfort, O comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and cry to her that she has served her term, that her penalty is paid, that she has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins.
Who's reading it? Go ahead. Go ahead, Jess.
In the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley shall be lifted up, and every mountain and hill be made low. The uneven ground shall become level, and the rough places a plain. Then the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all people shall see it together. For the mouth of the Lord has spoken.
I wrote a paper this week on a topic. I wrote it on sin. I'm not big on sin. It's like kind of hard to talk about sin. But I encountered this theologian named Dr. Andrew Park. He teaches at United Theological Seminary in Dayton, Ohio. He gave this talk at the school where I go, and he was talking about this idea of han. It's a Korean word. Han is the feeling of woundedness or brokenness. He says it's not sin exactly. It's a component of sin. It's part of it. But sin is an insufficient word to describe the experience that happens to the abused rather than the abuser. If the only word that we have is sin to describe what's happening to those comfort women, that is grossly inappropriate. They're not sinful. They did nothing wrong. They did nothing to bring about the experience that they've had. That is what Dr. Park would call han. He says Korea's 5,000-year history as a country, it's been invaded over 900 times. It's never invaded another nation. It's too small. But it's been invaded 900 times. In Korea, the word birds don't sing as they do in English. They cry. Clouds don't sing. I don't know. We don't have a word for what clouds do, but in Korea, they cry. There's this cultural, societal feeling of woundedness, brokenness. Something has happened to us. Nothing that we chose. Something that happened to us, a tragedy, and that's han. It's a result of sin. It's a result of someone doing something to you, right? But when we're reading Isaiah, when we're reading the prophets, and all we have to think about what they're dealing with is sin, someone did something wrong, and thus all these people are in exile for hundreds of years, I think that misses part of the point. Yes, the kings did things that were wrong. The ruling elites did things that directed a nation into exile, sure. But the people underneath, I don't know. I think han is more helpful. And then thinking about han as the energy that you absorb, that you receive because of a sinful action. Dr. Park calls han... It's like a star. When a star gets too big, it collapses, it becomes a black hole. It sucks everything in, and even light cannot escape from a black hole. He says the experience of han can be similar. Unresolved, han can consume. I think it's a powerful idea. When we're talking about the Israelites by the rivers of Babylon, Lamentations, a lot of these prophetic writings are deeply mournful, sad. They're expressing han. They're not expressing necessarily just an apology for sin or a request for forgiveness. They're asking for relief, for healing. The Eastern Orthodox writers often talk about sin as a disease, as harm, as hurt. That's similar to what Dr. Park is saying. The question then for the cosmology is, what does God care about? Does God care about sin only? Or does God care about han? Right? Is God only asking for repentance from the people who did wrong things? Be more obedient, be more perfect, do the right thing so that you can be with God? Or is God doing something else? So when we read what Isaiah is saying, Isaiah seems to be pointing to something else. He's saying comfort. She has served her term. Her penalty is paid. She's received from the Lord double for her sins. Every valley shall be lifted up. Every mountain shall be and hill be made low. This is something God is doing. This is an obedience. Someone want to read this, Isaiah 61, this first slide? There are two slides again. So someone read the first one. Someone read the second.
The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me because the Lord has anointed me. He has sent me to bring good news to the oppressed, to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and release to the prisoners, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor, and the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn.
To provide for those who mourn in Zion, to give them a garland instead of ashes, the oil of gladness of mourning, the mantle of praise instead of a faint spirit. They will be called oaks of righteousness, the planting of the Lord to display his glory. They shall build up the ancient ruins. They shall raise up the former devastations. They shall repair the ruined cities, the devastations.
can hear the ache of people that have been abused, that have been sent away from home, unable to follow rhythms of their own, unable to tend for their own land, to bring up generations, the younger ones, in their own space. This is the same passage in Luke that Jesus uses to announce the beginning of his own ministry. Dr. Park's final conclusion is that Jesus is the perfect example of God taking on Han, of God basically inverting the pyramid of David, saying, I'm not about activity through the kings anymore. I'm coming for the weakest. History is swinging on a new pivot, one of love and healing, mercy, rather than violence and oppression. This is going to be a kingdom where it's not about being the wisest, the strongest, the best, but where the last come first, where the foolish things of the world make fools of the wise, where the abused are healed, where valleys are lifted up and mountains are brought low, where the dead are raised, where the teachers of the law are shown to be liars and frauds, that we cannot free ourselves from the clutches of empire, but rescue is coming, where we don't look to the Constitution, but we look to the Sermon on the Mount. That's what the advent of Jesus can mean. Prophets help us see that. Prophets stand in the gap with people by the rivers of Babylon and point towards a future no one can comprehend. People are expecting a violent overthrow or a new king seated on the throne at Jerusalem who will do the same things that David did, but do them better, progress farther than any of us have gone, do things a little better. And Jesus flips that. Jesus, in fact, dies as one completely subject to Han, right? Jesus is full of Han when Jesus dies. Sinless, yes, but full of Han, that woundedness, that brokenness. Jesus dies as a suffering one, not just an ally, not just someone who comes alongside, but as the one who suffers. This is a quote from Victoria Safford. I got the privilege of spending a day with Parker Palmer yesterday. He's this wonderful Quaker man who does a lot about inner and outer healing, and that an inner wholeness can lead to our outer work being healthier. He writes this, he gave me this quote, and it was really great. Our mission is to plant ourselves at the gates of hope, not the prudent gates of optimism, which are somewhat narrower, nor the stalwart, boring gates of common sense, nor the strident gates of self-righteousness, which creak on shrill and angry hinges, for people cannot hear us there, they cannot pass through, nor the cheerful, flimsy garden gate of everything is going to be all right, but a very different, sometimes very lonely place, place of truth-telling, about your own soul, first of all, and its condition, the place of resistance and defiance, the piece of ground from which you see the world, both as it is and as it could be, as it might be, as it will be, the place from which you glimpse not only struggle, but joy in the struggle. And we stand there, beckoning and calling, telling people what we are seeing and asking people what they see. So the prophets see this first. That's what prophets do. They're not telling the future. They're not predicting the future. They're not diviners. But they're seeing the arc of what God is up to, saying, that's where we're going. That's where God is taking us. That's what God is doing. The future isn't just us trying to do things and make that happen. God is rushing it in towards us. Prophets may not build the way. They may just be artists, visionaries, people pointing the direction. Prophets may not even experience this thing that they're pointing to, this new imagination, but they see it. And they tell other people to take heart. Because rescue is coming. A new and beautiful work of God is afoot. So we see that in Isaiah. See it sometimes in Jeremiah. Jeremiah's a downer as well. But the prophets write about this pretty extensively. That our imagination, the imagination of God is much bigger. The kingdom is much broader and more extensive than we can imagine. So things that I'm giving you some practical things because it tells me to be practical. Joshua says I should give you practical things, which I think is fine. I'll be practical. Read the prophets. If you have some time this week, I think they're really interesting. I would say, one, remember the context that I'm telling you, right? That they're writing in the context of exile. They're writing in the context of hope for restoration. I would say spend some time with Isaiah 61. That's the one we just read. That's the one Jesus uses when he announces ministry. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me to announce freedom to the captives. If you're not involved in Compassion Team, to get involved. Last week, if you were here, you remember that we had the question, how many compassion teams are there at Circle of Hope? I don't know what the results were. I think they're in the binders when we send them around. I guess 8. There are 18. There are a lot. I was way off, and I'm like supposed to know. So if you've never encountered them or see what they do, like go to the website and take a look. There's some really beautiful things. They're doing that prophetic, hands on the ground, or feet on the ground, hands in the dirt work of resolving some of this Han of our neighborhoods, the Han of our city. Artists, if you are an artist, prophetic work is for you. This is for you. Walter Brueggemann writes about this really well in a book called The Prophetic Imagination. If you have a few hours, I recommend reading. It's only like 100 pages. He says the work of a prophet is not just to criticize what is, right? To look at what is and rip it apart, although that's necessary. That needs to happen because we live in empire. And it's not just to energize, which he says is more what conservatives tend to do. Just let's do a thing, let's do it really well. But when both come together, that's where the prophetic really takes root, and that's where our imaginations are expanded. If you are an artist, make something with this in mind. Make something with this question of hope. Is this hope really coming? Is this false idealism? Is this wishful thinking? Or is God actually doing something? How does this fit together? If you're not an artist, I would still say, do something artistic. Marshall McLuhan says the artists are the only ones who see systems for what they actually are, who see through, see beyond the forms that constrain us. If you are not an artist, if you don't want to try artistic things, go experience some art. Go see someone who's doing this. I would recommend this guy named Titus Kaphar. I heard him talk the other week. He's doing a lot of work with the monuments question. You know, all these Confederate, there it is. Confederate monuments. He's saying we shouldn't just remove them. We shouldn't keep them. So we should converse with them. He says there's a third way. Actually bring some artists into the conversation and let them find ways to take these monuments that we have and do something new with them. So he's doing that, right? So one, there's this big horse, and he worked on it with his son, who's like 4 or 5 years old. They just took the horse guy off the pedestal and then put some other things around it. So there's like statues of enslaved people who were sold by this dude. It's like really interesting work. Artists do that, right? Artists help us see beyond that. The technicians, maybe, right? Mathematicians, maybe they'll help us actually figure out how to put the statue there. But the artists are the ones who can see through the systems.
Thanks for listening to Circle of Hope's Sunday Meeting Podcast. If you want to talk about it or get connected to a cell, you can find one under our Connect dropdown at circleofhope.net.